I next met with Dr. Jennifer Woyak, and to begin, I asked her to comment on her current approach to first-line therapy of CLL.
So this is definitely an exciting time in CLL. So prior to ASH last year, we still had the open questions for people with CLL that were in need of treatment that had never had treatment before. Was chemoimmunotherapy better or was ibrutinib better? And so ibrutinib was FDA approved for the frontline treatment of CLL in 2016. And there have been a lot of people who have adopted that as part of their general practice. But a lot of people were still using chemoimmunotherapy, generally FCR, fludarabine, cyclophosphamide, and rituximab, for patients who were younger and fit, and bendamustine plus rituximab for patients either who were older, who were unfit, or if there was just concern about the toxicities associated with FCR. So at ASH, there were two abstracts presented that were the results of phase 3 randomized trials. The first was in younger patients, and this was an NCTN trial run by ECOG, and it was randomizing patients under the age of 70 to either FCR or ibrutinib plus rituximab. And very interestingly, ibrutinib plus rituximab was superior to FCR in terms of both progression-free survival and overall survival. One of the important limitations of the study is that patients who were IGVH mutated, so those that already have a very good prognosis, did well in both arms so far. So I think there's still some debate as to whether those patients with IGVH mutated disease who might actually be cured by FCR should still receive the ibrutinib and rituximab, or whether they would do better with chemoimmunotherapy. But overall, that tells us that for younger patients, ibrutinib regimens are superior to chemotherapy. Then in older patients, we had the Alliance AO41202 trial, which took patients age 65 and older and randomized them to either BR, ibrutinib alone, or ibrutinib plus rituximab. And in this study, ibrutinib and ibrutinib plus rituximab were superior to BR in terms of progression-free survival. No difference in overall survival at this time, but there was a crossover. And also, there was no difference in progression-free survival between ibrutinib and IR. So telling us that ibrutinib-based regimens are more effective than BR, but that there is likely no need to add the rituximab. So ibrutinib monotherapy is probably the best option. Around the same time, the results of the Illuminate study came out as well, which was ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab versus clarambucil plus obinutuzumab, and showed the same thing. So ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab was better than clarambucil plus obinutuzumab in terms of progression-free survival. So then in a post-ASH period, there has, I think, been more adoption of ibrutinib as the standard frontline therapy for patients with CLL, except for those who, you know, have a contraindication to receiving ibrutinib. More recently at ASCO, the results of the CLL14 study came out, and that was venetoclax plus obinutuzumab versus clarambucil plus obinutuzumab. And that was for patients who were kind of unfit for more aggressive chemoimmunotherapy. That showed that venetoclax plus obinutuzumab had better progression-free survival than clarambucil plus obinutuzumab. And importantly, kind of differentiating this regimen from ibrutinib is that venetoclax obinutuzumab is a one-year regimen as opposed to indefinite ibrutinib treatment.
Can you talk also in terms of what was seen there in terms of MRD?
Yep. So with ibrutinib, you don't expect to see minimal residual disease negativity in a few people who are in early lines of therapy. A few years after starting, we sometimes see MRD negativity, but for the most part, there is detectable MRD at almost all time points on ibrutinib monotherapy. With venetoclax-based regimens, there are much higher rates of MRD negativity. And with venetoclax, as opposed to ibrutinib, it's important to get to MRD negativity. So every study with venetoclax alone, with rituximab, and it seems like with obinutuzumab too, patients who are MRD negative do better overall than those who remain MRD positive.
Do we know at this point whether or not it would make sense to utilize MRD in terms of whether or not to continue therapy or not?
So that's a great question, and is really the basis of a lot of trials right now. I think we probably know enough with venetoclax to say that, you know, that could be used as a reason to discontinue treatment. And I'll say sometimes if I have people who are on venetoclax post-ibrutinib, so like a really high-risk patient population, I don't tend to stop treatment in patients who are still MRD positive. So I've usually been adopting the Murano data in that population, which is venetoclax plus rituximab. And that regimen goes for 2 years. However, if I have patients who are doing well at 2 years but are not MRD negative, I usually will continue the venetoclax.
Interesting. Any preference, as long as we brought up MRD, in terms of MRD assay type?
So right now, the standard assay and the one that's like easiest to get clinically is flow-based assays. And so that's where almost all the data comes from, is using like MRD for one cell per 10,000 leukocytes. You can get a lot more sensitive using next-generation sequencing. For CLL, that's not really something that I would advocate just for clinical practice, but is being done as parts of clinical trials and might be useful eventually.
So before we start hearing about some of your cases, maybe you can just sort of summarize where we are in terms of first-line therapy, because I'd say it's gotten pretty confusing.
Yeah. So, you know, it's definitely an interesting discussion to have with patients right now. So what to do for frontline treatment. And so there is much more data right now in terms of long-term follow-up for indefinite ibrutinib treatment as opposed to anything else like venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. So usually I'll talk to patients about ibrutinib as one of the standard frontline therapies, kind of the limitations being the need for indefinite therapy and some of the toxicities, which can be quite problematic, things like atrial fibrillation, hypertension, joint pains, things like that. Then we'll talk about that there's more data for sequence of ibrutinib than venetoclax rather than the other way around. But alternatively, we certainly can do venetoclax plus obinutuzumab, a well-tolerated, time-limited regimen, major side effects with that being neutropenia, sometimes some GI side effects, and then just a little bit more inconvenience in terms of the dose escalation initially, but then you have that obvious advantage to stopping therapy after a year. So a lot of times it comes down to the desire for indefinite treatment versus wanting to go with the longer-term data and not being as worried about taking a pill for long periods of time.
Did you say GI problems with venetoclax obinutuzumab?
Yeah, so with both ibrutinib and with venetoclax, there is some diarrhea, which in my experience with venetoclax, it's either no issues or pretty significant issues. Whereas with ibrutinib, most people will have some GI toxicity, but it doesn't tend to be therapy limiting.
Yeah, no, what got my attention was about the venetoclax is I actually don't even remember hearing about any kind of like side effects other than TLS and cytopenias, but GI, that's new. For me.
Yeah, you know, it's not that common, but I've had a few patients where we've had to stop venetoclax because of diarrhea. And sometimes it takes a long time to get better, too.
Interesting. So you mentioned the fact that now there are options. I guess one of the interesting thing is, would you consider BR an option?
I usually don't consider BR as a good option right now. You know, I think if you kind of extrapolate the data from one trial to another, which is always difficult to do, what we're seeing in terms of efficacy with venetoclax plus obinutuzumab at the time periods we've gotten to, which is just a couple years, is fairly similar to ibrutinib. And, you know, whether or not that holds for 3-5 years, we don't know yet. But I think at 2 years, the two regimens are fairly equivalent and definitely better than what is reported in trials with bendamustine rituximab. So I usually don't consider that as one of the best options right now.
What about chemotherapy or BR in relapse? You know, it seems like almost all patients are now going to be getting novel therapy. Does that mean they're never going to get chemo, or more likely that they're going to get it in relapse?
Yep. Probably never. So there's not a lot of data for chemotherapy after novel agents, but anecdotally, most people can tell you of experiences where it hasn't worked. And I would say I haven't tried it very often, but I have not seen chemotherapy work well after novel therapies.
And just out of curiosity, are you bringing up FCR? You have a younger patient with mutated disease. Do you offer that as an option? And how do you present that?
So I still do. I think that, you know, with the ECOG data, you certainly could just say that ibrutinib plus rituximab is better for everybody. But I think that that's a special group of patients that, you know, if people are, you know, usually my cutoff in age is 65. So 65 and younger, healthy, and IGVH mutated without FISH abnormalities that would be unfavorable, I will offer FCR as the chance for a curative regimen.
Let's hear about your 76-year-old lady and how that played out.
So I have a 76-year-old lady with CLL who I followed for a number of years now, diagnosed, I think, about 5 years or so ago. And we'd been watching and waiting, had IGVH unmutated disease, but normal FISH. And it came time for treatment about 3 months ago when she began to have anemia that was related to CLL involvement in the bone marrow and as well as some progressive fatigue. So we talked about options at that time, really since we had the data from ASH of ibrutinib alone versus we talked a little bit about chlorambucil obinutuzumab and then clinical trial options. And she elected to proceed with single agent ibrutinib treatment. She's been on it about 3 months now and is tolerating it relatively well. I think a lot of people will have some side effects, especially in the beginning. So she's having some bruising, which is pretty ubiquitous with ibrutinib, and is having a little bit of joint pain, which is not limiting her activities.
And what about the disease?
Oh, she's had a remarkable response. Within even the first couple weeks, she said that she could feel her lymph nodes getting smaller. And over the course of 3 months, we've seen a pretty steady improvement in her hemoglobin. Not quite normal yet, but definitely improved.
What exactly kind of bruising does she have? And what's the spectrum of bleeding issues that you see with ibrutinib?
So significant bleeding is relatively rare, really about 3% to 5% on most of the trials now. Certainly, it's higher in people who are on aspirin or on blood thinners. Notably, warfarin is contraindicated with ibrutinib, but you know there are still people who are on a DOAC for DVT or for atrial fibrillation or something like that. Mild bruising you see in almost everybody with ibrutinib. So this patient tells me that she will develop bruises on her, usually her upper extremities, sometimes even when she doesn't remember bumping them. But if she definitely runs into something, she knows she'll get a bruise there. That's usually what we see. And while it can be a little unnerving to the patients at first, over time they get used to it. It's not dangerous. I have seen a few people where the bruising is quite significant and have stopped for bruising in a few people. Significant bleeding is a lot more rare. Now, for anybody who has significant bleeding or bruising that is pretty bad, I often will take them off and not restart just because we do now have other options.
And you also mentioned she had joint pain. Again, what kind of problems did she have and what's the spectrum that you see in terms of arthralgias?
Yeah, so her joint pain is relatively mild. It tends to move around, which is what we typically see with ibrutinib. So sometimes people will have knee pain, other times it'll move to the elbows or the shoulders. Most people can tolerate it, sometimes with Tylenol. We usually tell people to try to avoid NSAIDs just because of the bleeding risk. If people have been on ibrutinib for a little while, don't have any bleeding, I will tell them they can take an NSAID from time to time for the joint pain. I've also had some people where the joint pain was a little bit more significant and really interfering with their activities, where I've tried low-dose prednisone, which works very well. Many times you can do a week or two of 10 to 20 milligrams of prednisone a day. And for some people, that resolves it completely. Some people, you have to repeat that every 6 months or so. If people require more than that, or if it's really limiting their activities, though, I would consider switching treatment.
You know, initially, we were seeing reports of a fair number of people coming off ibrutinib because of tolerability issues. I heard different numbers quoted, 30%, even more than that. But I wonder what it is nowadays, now that it's been out there a while and people are kind of used to it. In your own hands, you know, what do you see? You know, what's your estimate based on data and your own experience about the chance of somebody having to actually stop because of tolerability issues?
So I definitely wonder the same thing about the real world experiences, whether they'd be different if done now, just since people do have such a lot more experience with ibrutinib. I would say in my experience and in our experience on the clinical trials we've done at Ohio State, probably 20% or so will come off at some point because of toxicity. But yeah, the real world numbers are much higher than that. In some cases, almost half of people, especially in the frontline setting. And I think that's probably related more to the tolerance of the toxicity for both the patient and the physician. But I think now that we know much more about the efficacy, it's a better calculation in terms of balancing the efficacy and the tolerability.
I think also people have different ways they manage tolerability issues. Do you find that dose reduction is helpful?
For some toxicities, I think it is helpful. Like I've had a few people with mouth sores, and that tends to respond well to a dose reduction. Sometimes the joint pain does, although I haven't had a lot of success with responsiveness to reduction in the dose. Things that don't respond, I don't think the hypertension improves with dose reduction. The atrial fibrillation risk, I don't think changes with a dose reduction. Occasionally, the bruising does decrease with a dose reduction too.
And there's also, I guess, a difference between how people manage tolerability toxicity issues. And I'm curious if you've had patients who developed atrial fibrillation on ibrutinib and what you do if their disease is under good control and otherwise they're tolerating therapy well.
Mm-hmm. And my approach to AFib with ibrutinib has really changed a lot over time. So at first, you know, most of the patients that were being treated with ibrutinib didn't have a lot of other options. And, you know, I would just push through and try to keep them on the drug, try to keep them on the full dose and manage the atrial fibrillation as best we could. Now we have venetoclax, and although off-label, we have acalabrutinib, which is FDA-approved for mantle cell lymphoma and doesn't appear to have as much risk of atrial fibrillation as ibrutinib does. So in my practice now, I generally am taking people off of ibrutinib if they develop AFib, and either if they still need disease control, I'll switch them to acalabrutinib, or sometimes I've even taken people off and then, you know, just waited until progression and then treated with acalabrutinib. It's kind of interesting because there's a lot of variability in terms of how people do when you take them off the drug. So some people you can take off the drug and they will go years before they need additional treatment. Some people will need more treatment very quickly. And it's hard to predict based upon their level of disease control or how long they've been on the drug.
I saw a paper that you were involved with that brought up the issue of opportunistic infections with ibrutinib that I wasn't even aware of. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so we looked at about 600 patients that were treated at our institution retrospectively and looked for the incidence of opportunistic infections, things like fungal infections, disseminated viral infections, PCP. There had been another report that had shown an elevated risk of PJP pneumonia in frontline patients treated with ibrutinib. And then there was an experience in CNS lymphoma with patients on ibrutinib and steroids that had a really high rate of aspergillus infections. And those were the things that kind of prompted us to look at this in our patients. We did not find any cases of PJP pneumonia in our patients. Notably, there were quite a few people who already were prophylaxed for it. We didn't see any disseminated viral infections, although a lot of people, again, were on viral prophylaxis. We did have 26 patients, I believe, who developed fungal infections, and for the most part, that was all confirmed or suspected aspergillus, almost all of those cases. And we know that that's actually a BTK-specific risk. So BTK is important in the response to aspergillus infections in terms of you need BTK for the monocytes to function and be able to recruit the neutrophils to eradicate the fungus. And that's been shown in a variety of experimental models. So that appears to actually be a specific risk for all BTK inhibitors.
Do you use anti-infective prophylaxis in patients on ibrutinib?
Not generally. And actually, in the experience that I reported, most people were actually on the anti-infective prophylaxis therapies they'd been on before.
Oh, other therapy. Oh, okay. That's,
yeah.
I was wondering
so,
why
you
they
know,
were.
They'd previously been on something that required prophylaxis, okay. And it just never was discontinued.
Got it.
But yeah, I generally don't do any prophylaxis.
Right. Yeah, I still am trying to figure out the immune effects of ibrutinib. And, you know, like, amazing to me that it's using GVHD. But
yeah.
What you just said about the aspergillus, that's very interesting. Any other sort of broad strokes about how ibrutinib affects immunity?
Yeah, so ibrutinib is really an interesting drug, and it has a lot of effects on other immune cells. So probably mostly because it affects ITK in addition to BTK. It has some effects on T cell function and switches the CD4 T cells from a TH2 to a TH1 phenotype. So TH2 phenotypes is what you tend to see in advanced cancers, and it's kind of an immunosuppressive phenotype. So the helper T cells in those patients don't tend to work very well. And ibrutinib over time actually changes that to the TH1 response, which is more cytotoxic and actually can be more effective in immunity. So probably most of the effect on T cells is actually good and actually would help the immune system over time. It has some varying effects on macrophages. It inhibits NK cell ADCC, which is probably the reason why ibrutinib combined with an antibody isn't that effective. But I think in general, we see that the immune cells become more normal on ibrutinib, and probably not only because you're relieving some of like the CLL-induced immunosuppression.
I think I heard somebody talking about ibrutinib and CAR T.
Yep. So ibrutinib in the laboratory actually helps to generate CAR T cells from CLL patients. So we know one of the big limitations for CAR T cells with CLL is that CAR T cells just don't generate in vitro. And that's just because of the profound like T cell immunosuppression you get in CLL. But our group actually, in collaboration with the group at Penn, looked at patients who had been on ibrutinib for over 6 months and compared kind of baseline to the later time points on ibrutinib and whether you could generate CAR T cells from the patients, and found that actually at those later time points on ibrutinib, you could generate the CAR T cells better in vitro. And so now there's actually a clinical trial of ibrutinib plus CAR T cells, which has very promising data.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I never quite got why, you know, I guess CLL was one of the first things that CAR T was used for at Penn, mm-hmm. and yet it kind of fell behind, you know, the lymphomas, et cetera. Do you see CAR T having a role or a future role or even current role?
You know, I do. I think you're right. It is not as effective in CLL, or at least the way we're doing it right now is not as effective in CLL as it is in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma or in ALL. And, you know, there's probably cellular factors and patient factors to that, as well as potentially disease factors. But I see that it may have a role in the future, probably more so for those patients who you might otherwise consider for a stem cell transplant. Certainly, it doesn't have like the long-term toxicities as you see with some stem cell transplant. And, you know, especially in this disease where most patients are older, I think it may open up like some potentially curative or at least long-term remission therapies to those patients.
So we've talked about the potential issues that people may run into with ibrutinib. Let's talk a little bit about acalabrutinib, which you've been involved with in terms of clinical research. And maybe to get into that, we can hear about your 68-year-old man.
Yeah, so this actually is a patient of mine, 68 years old. I have a number of patients like this, actually. But he had been on a couple therapies prior to ibrutinib, was started on ibrutinib, but unfortunately, after 6 months, developed atrial fibrillation. This was 3 years ago now, so at that point, acalabrutinib wasn't available commercially. But there was a clinical trial for patients who had been intolerant to ibrutinib where they could go on acalabrutinib. So this gentleman actually was treated at another center, and his atrial fibrillation was managed. He was restarted on the ibrutinib, but unfortunately, again, developed atrial fibrillation, which was pretty difficult to control. So we put him on this trial of acalabrutinib, and he's done remarkably well over 3 years. His disease is still under good control. He has not had any recurrent atrial fibrillation. And he actually tells me that he feels a little better on the acalabrutinib just because of some of the other low-grade toxicities he had experienced on ibrutinib.
So any issues with headache with this man? I've heard about headache and acalabrutinib.
Yeah, headaches are very common within the first few months of treatment. I'm not sure exactly what percentage, but I think it's about 50%, maybe even a little bit more of people will develop headaches, which is interesting because you don't see that with other BTK inhibitors like ibrutinib. But they generally resolve after the first few months. So, you know, people usually can tolerate them if they take a Tylenol or something like that, and they go away with time. So I actually can't even remember whether he had headaches or not, but certainly I've seen that.
I've heard people say that caffeine helps the headaches. Is that your experience?
Mm-hmm.
Seems kind of strange in a way. What do you think the pathophysiology is, or what's going on about why they get it and why it gets better with caffeine?
Yeah, honestly, I have no idea, because there's not any targets that I know of that acalabrutinib hits that ibrutinib doesn't. They both cross the blood-brain barrier, so there's not really a good reason why you would see it with only acalabrutinib.
What is the spectrum of kinase activity of acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib versus other BTK inhibitors, and how much of a difference theoretically could it make?
Yeah. So the other irreversible inhibitors all are more selective than ibrutinib. So ibrutinib is the least selective, which could have advantages or disadvantages, but acalabrutinib specifically is quite a bit more selective. It doesn't hit ITK notably, which increases the potential for it to have efficacy in combination with antibodies. But as well, you know, there are a lot of toxicities that occur with ibrutinib that we're not sure whether they're BTK toxicities or whether they're alternative target toxicities. But I think you can tell from the side effect profile between those drugs, like which of the toxicities tend to be more BTK specific.
Interesting. So this man now sounds like he's doing really well. What would you do if you had disease progression?
So actually, interestingly, just at the last visit, so at Ohio State, we tend to test people every 3 months or whenever we see them to see if they've developed a resistance mutation in BTK. And he just had his first positive test on that. So we actually know that he will become resistant to the drug. No signs of clinical resistance right now. He's feeling great. But in our experience, there's a median of about 9 months between a positive BTK resistance assay and when somebody will relapse. With him, I will probably do something like venetoclax outside of a clinical trial, or, you know, preferentially a clinical trial either involving venetoclax or another novel agent.
How would you use venetoclax alone, and for what duration?
So usually I'm now giving the venetoclax in combination with rituximab. So the clinical trial that was done in patients after progression, either on ibrutinib or after a period of time off ibrutinib, patients went on to venetoclax alone, and response rate in that patient population was about 65%, and the progression-free survival is about 2 years. And in that study, the venetoclax was given indefinitely. It looks like venetoclax is probably more effective when given with an antibody, so I'll usually give it with rituximab right now, with a planned duration of 2 years for the venetoclax.
Would you be tempted, or would you like to use obinutuzumab with venetoclax instead of rituximab in this recurrent situation?
That's a great question, and I don't know. Obinutuzumab might be a little bit more effective than rituximab, but I don't know. We just don't have a lot of data outside of the CLL-11 trial, which compared like clarambicil, clarambicil rituximab, clarambicil obinutuzumab. And it looks from that obinutuzumab is superior to rituximab. Whether that makes a difference when combined with such an effective drug like venetoclax, I don't know. So I still will do venetoclax rituximab in that situation.
So can you talk a little bit about the data that's out there right now with acalabrutinib and how it compares indirectly? Of course, eventually we'll see a direct comparison, but indirectly it compares to ibrutinib in terms of what's seen, particularly in terms of efficacy parameters.
Mm-hmm. I think they're a little bit difficult to compare for me because the populations tend to be really different on the studies. So I think in general, like the early stage ibrutinib trials have higher risk patients than the early stage acalabrutinib studies. Definitely though, the two drugs look like they should be equivalently effective. And the acalabrutinib data looks a little bit more positive in the setting of relapse CLL when given as monotherapy. So the progression-free survivals with acalabrutinib are reportedly longer than what was in the ibrutinib studies. But again, it's really difficult, I think, to compare those patient populations.
So I was telling you now that our primary target here is the general medical oncologist. I'm just trying to imagine how you can even keep up. You can imagine the number of interviews and people I've talked to about CLL. And I think you're the first person, at least that I can remember, talking about this resistance assay.
Uh-huh.
What is that? Has it been out there for a couple of years? I never heard of it.
It's actually an OSU-specific assay, so
that's probably why
nobody else has mentioned it. But so we know that when patients become resistant to ibrutinib and probably to all of the irreversible inhibitors that have that same target, The most predominant mechanism of relapse is the acquisition of a mutation in BTK at the binding site. So it's a cysteine to serine mutation.
Wow.
So what that does is it changes the binding of the drug from irreversible to reversible. And it changes the binding kinetics such that it binds like very, very short duration. So it goes from like a irreversible inhibitor to about 7 minutes of binding. And in retrospective studies that we've done, NHLBI has looked at this in similar cohorts of patients, and it seems like about 85 to 90% of patients who progress do so by this mechanism. And there are commercial assays to look for this mutation, and a lot of practitioners do it at the time of relapse. We'll look for the mutation at the time of relapse. We looked at our patients who had relapsed with the mutation and kind of going backwards from there, looked to see if we could detect the mutation before patients relapsed. And we found that we could. And there was a median of 9 months between when a patient had the first detectable resistance mutation and when they relapsed. Now, there are some people who can go years, actually, with these mutations before they relapse. But most patients, you know, patients will eventually relapse on those. So we generally, after somebody has been on a BTK inhibitor for a year, start testing them, and we just test them serially. And when we detect a mutation, we actually are doing a study right now where when patients develop a resistance mutation, we add venetoclax to ibrutinib.
Wow.
Because we know when people relapse on ibrutinib, if you let them clinically relapse, it is a very fulminant disease. You know, people get sick very, very quickly. It's sometimes really hard to get them on to their next treatment. And so the thought behind this trial is if we could take people who are still in clinical remission, maybe we could keep them from relapsing and prolong their progression-free survival with the regimen.
So interesting. So I assume you don't see this de novo if they haven't had a BTK inhibitor?
That's right, yeah. So a number of groups have looked at, you know, large numbers of CLL patients, and it's never, to my knowledge, been detected without exposure to a BTK inhibitor.
That's really wild. You know, it reminds me a little bit, you know, about the T790 story and EGFR tumor mutations and lung cancer that, you know, developed on erlotinib, and then they gave osimertinib that worked, and then now osimertinib moved up to first line. I wonder, maybe, are there BTK inhibitors out there that can overcome this mutation?
There actually are. There's a number of them in clinical development right now, which were designed for this purpose, to try to overcome this mutation. So the best irreversible target in ibrutinib is that site. So all the irreversible inhibitors, ibrutinib, acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, tirabrutinib, they all have the same binding site. But the newer reversible inhibitors, and that's SNS-062 or vecabrutinib, ARQ-531, LOXO-305, and I think there is even other ones that I'm not aware of, they're designed to target BTK reversibly and outside of that same binding site. So they all seem to have activity, at least preclinically, when ibrutinib stops working. And so only vecabrutinib and ARQ-531 are the only ones that have clinical data presented so far. And they both look promising. You know, the ARQ data is a little bit more mature, but they both probably have activity in that patient population.
Any kind of situation right now where you'd start out with acalabrutinib on a patient, maybe somebody's already got atrial fibrillation, anticoagulated, older?
Yep. So yeah, those are mostly exactly when I would consider it. So somebody who has poorly controlled atrial fibrillation, or even atrial fibrillation that's intermittent and they're not, you know, if they're always in atrial fibrillation, it probably doesn't matter. But in somebody who has intermittent AFib, I would consider acalabrutinib. Those that have a history of ventricular arrhythmias, because we know that there is a risk of ventricular arrhythmias with ibrutinib, although very low, it is still existent. And patients who have known bleeding complications, I might think about, although I'm not all that sure that the bleeding risk is that different between the two drugs.
So interesting. Well, we've been talking about venetoclax. Let's hear about a patient who got it. You have this 66-year-old lady. I guess she was initially diagnosed in 2007. You started treating her in 2010. She's gotten a bunch of things. What happened at the point at which she got venetoclax?
Yeah, so she had been on ibrutinib actually for 5 years, has very high-risk CLL, 17p deletion, complex karyotype, IGVH unmutated. progressed on ibrutinib. You know, we had been doing the assay. We knew she developed a resistance mutation. At the time, we didn't have any clinical trials that were specifically addressing that population. So we waited until she clinically relapsed on ibrutinib and then started her on venetoclax. Generally, if I'm doing this outside of a clinical trial, if I'm changing from ibrutinib to venetoclax, I continue the ibrutinib through the dose escalation of venetoclax. And then often I stop at that point and then just continue on with the venetoclax. So this woman did very well with the venetoclax dose escalation, has been on the drug for about 2 years and is doing well. She's had some intermittent issues with neutropenia and some thrombocytopenia as well.
So when you initially started the venetoclax, what was her white count, her tumor situation in terms of nodes, and how did you approach TLS prevention in her?
Yeah, so because I knew that she was going to relapse, I didn't wait until she was high TLS risk before I switched her. So I think her white count was probably only in the teens, and she has some abdominal lymph nodes that were, you know, a little bit bigger, like 3 or 4 centimeters, but certainly still fell into that low intermediate risk for venetoclax tumor lysis risk. So I treated her outpatient. I did the conventional stepwise dose escalation over the course of 5 weeks. I think in somebody who has a fairly minimal disease burden, who is not relapsing very quickly, it's pretty easy to make that transition and to still do like the 5 week escalation.
I'm always interested when I ask people in a patient who is higher risk that you're going to bring in the hospital, how long do you keep them in the hospital? What exactly do you do in the hospital?
So the label indication, or the way that we're meant to do it right now, is that for at least the first two doses, so the 20 milligram and then the 50 milligram, you bring them in the hospital. We generally bring them in the night before they start, give them some hydration, and then start the venetoclax in the morning, and then check tumor lysis labs at least by 6 hours post-venetoclax. Sometimes we do 4, 8, and 12 hours, and then definitely at 24 hours. And if I don't see any evidence of tumor lysis at 24 hours post-dose, I will discharge them and then let them come back for the next dose. If they don't have TLS with the first two dose escalations, you don't have to keep doing it inpatient, although you certainly can if worried about that.
Just kind of curious, in this patient, you said she'd been on ibrutinib for 5 years. Now she's on venetoclax for 2 years. Imagine if I told somebody like 4 years ago that story.
I know.
I'm just kind of curious, quality life-wise, in this particular patient, ibrutinib versus venetoclax.
You know, for her, I would say pretty similar. She actually tolerated the ibrutinib really well. I don't even think she had bothersome joint pain. So I think that her quality of life has been really excellent on both, and definitely better than when she was receiving the chemotherapy.
Right. Where do you see things heading in terms of new strategies? I mentioned the fact that you never would have dreamed this 4 years ago. What do you think we'll be doing like in 2 years?
Yeah, so probably the most exciting data that has come out recently, there's been 3 studies that have been presented at multiple meetings. One is the CLARITY study from the UK that combined ibrutinib and venetoclax in the relapse setting. We have the CAPTIVATE study from MD Anderson that had those same 2 drugs combined in the frontline setting. And then a trial from Ohio State, a phase 1b/2 study where we combined ibrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab in both the frontline and the relapse settings. And I think, you know, you would expect that ibrutinib and venetoclax given individually are great. Together, they should be very effective, and they really, really are. But I think that's something that a lot of people are very excited about, the possibility of that combination in either relapsed or moving toward frontline therapy and allowing the possibility for discontinuation of ibrutinib.
What do we know about recapture of patients after treatment's been discontinued?
Mm-hmm. So on those particular studies, not a lot. The first 2 that I mentioned, very few patients have discontinued drug. Our study from Ohio State that Dr. Carrie Rogers is leading, we have about 1 year of time off the therapy. And I think still only 1 patient has relapsed and was able to be retreated with ibrutinib. You know, we expect that you should be able to treat really with either ibrutinib or venetoclax afterward. What we know so far about resistance to venetoclax, there is a resistance mutation, amino acid 101. It's a GlyVal mutation. It is probably not as predominant as the BTK mutation, but it seems to appear in a large number of patients who relapse on venetoclax. But again, just like the mutations with ibrutinib, you don't see it de novo and you don't see it early on in treatment. So if you give the combination for a year or even probably 18 months or a little longer, you're pretty unlikely to develop those mutations. So I would expect that you should be able to retreat with either of those drugs.
You were talking before about resistance mechanisms to BTK inhibitors. What about resistance to venetoclax?
So there was an abstract at ASH last year, was published in Cancer Discovery at the same time with a group that had looked initially at just a few patients and kind of expanded after that. And there is a point mutation in BCL2 that seems to confer resistance to venetoclax. It tends to not be seen before a couple years of treatment with the drug. And it is not seen in as many patients as we see the BTK mutation. So I don't think we can say at this time that 75 or 80% of the patients who relapse on venetoclax do so by that mechanism. But at least we have a mechanism for some patients.
Can you talk about the role of PLC gamma 2 mutations in the development of resistance to BTK inhibitors?
Yeah, so PLC gamma 2 is the kinase in the B cell receptor pathway that's immediately downstream of BTK. And we've found that there are some patients who relapse specifically by developing a mutation in PLC gamma 2. So BTK is still inhibited by ibrutinib, but the cell kind of turns back on its signaling machinery. You know, after looking at lots and lots and lots of patients, it is actually pretty rare to have that PLC gamma 2 mutation or those mutations by themselves. Usually we now see them in addition to a BTK mutation. I can probably count on one hand the number of patients I've seen that only have a mutation in PLC gamma 2, but it certainly does appear to confer resistance.
So I want to talk a little bit about Richter's transformation, but before we do, maybe talk a little bit about patients who get beyond ibrutinib and venetoclax. I'm not sure how many do nowadays, but in terms of other treatment options, particularly PI3 kinase inhibitors.
Mm-hmm. So I would say there are more and more patients getting to that point. You know, like I mentioned, the data that we have for venetoclax after ibrutinib, the median PFS is about 2 years. So there are a lot of patients now that are getting to that 2-year mark and are starting to relapse on venetoclax. And you're right, they don't have a lot of good options. So PI3 kinase inhibitors, so both idelalisib and duvelisib are commercially available. They definitely have some efficacy, even in this like really refractory patient population. You know, my experience has been that the remissions to those tend to be pretty transient after ibrutinib and venetoclax. The PI3 kinase inhibitors seem to work a little bit better if you do them a little earlier in treatment, but definitely they can be used as a bridge to something else. And unfortunately, there is really not a lot of other standard options that you can give a patient with CLL at this time. Lenalidomide and rituximab is an active regimen in CLL, definitely different mechanism than other things that patients have been exposed to, but it takes a little while to work, so it's not all that helpful in that really refractory patient population. And I think like really those patients need to be on clinical trials. So I mentioned reversible BTK inhibitors that are in trials. There's a number of other targets within the B cell receptor pathway that look like they're interesting, things like PKC beta. There's other mechanisms entirely like BRD4. There's inhibitors of BRD4 and of bromodomain receptors that look like they might be helpful in that setting. And then, of course, CAR T cells. That's probably like the prime area to study CAR T cells.
Do you have trials available right now for CAR T that you can put patients on with CLL?
So at OSU, we have one that is very, very close. There are a few other centers that have ongoing studies right now, though.
Interesting. You mentioned in terms of efficacy, any comments about tolerability issues with PI3 kinase inhibitors or the dalalisib, you know, which has been out there the longest? You know, heard about these immune things, delayed pneumonitis, et cetera. Any experience with that?
Yeah, so PI3 kinase inhibitors are really difficult to give for long periods of time. So the pneumonitis that can happen often happens a little bit earlier on. And, you know, that's something that usually requires drug discontinuation and high-dose steroids for a period of time. Probably the more common therapy-limiting toxicity is the diarrhea. So there's like an early diarrhea you get with PI3 kinase inhibitors that you can usually treat through with Imodium that I don't think is necessarily immune-mediated. But then there's that late-onset diarrhea that happens after 6 months that is definitely like an immune-mediated colitis. And that, again, can be very difficult to treat and usually requires steroids, either systemic or the non-systemically absorbed GI steroids.
So I would like to ask you about this other case, but a couple other things just to sort of maybe do a quick journal club from ASCA. You had several really interesting papers. Are you involved with that? One paper on acalabrutinib and obinutuzumab. Any comments on that combination?
Yeah, so we did a relatively small study at Ohio State of acalabrutinib plus obinutuzumab. You know, I mentioned that ibrutinib inhibits NK cell ADCC, which at least in vitro limits its ability to be combined with antibodies. Acalabrutinib doesn't inhibit ITK, so we think that it in vitro combines very well with antibodies, so that kind of led to this trial. And we treated patients both treatment naive and relapsed and refractory. We have follow-up now of over 3 years in both patient population, and the combination is extremely well-tolerated, extremely effective. So over 70% of patients are still on drug after 3 years. In the relapse setting, progression-free survival is about 94%. Relapsed and refractory patients at 4 years, it's 73%. There have been a few patients who developed Richter's transformation on the combination, but we've actually only had one patient so far progress with CLL in the entire study.
So I guess there's not a phase 3 trial out there comparing acalabrutinib alone or with obinutuzumab?
Not yet. Actually, there is a phase 3 trial that is completed, which is clarambicil obinutuzumab versus acalabrutinib alone versus acalabrutinib plus obinutuzumab. It's been accrued for a while now, so hopefully we'll read out very soon.
Oh, yeah, that'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
Everybody beats up on clarambicil nowadays, it seems, or at least.
Yep. Probably not for much longer, though.
Not for much longer, yeah, that's for sure. So, yeah, another paper you had at ASCA that I was interested in, second cancer incidence in patients with CLL getting BTK inhibitors.
Yep. Yeah, so we took our large cohort of patients at Ohio State and looked retrospectively to see what the incidence was of secondary cancers and what was the spectrum of secondary cancers. There's a lot of data in CLL. We know that patients just in general have a high incidence of secondary cancers, likely due to just the immune suppression related to the disease. Non-melanoma skin cancers are the most common. So in our BTK inhibitor-treated patient population, we had a relatively high incidence of non-melanoma skin cancers. We also saw about 10% of patients developed other more invasive cancers, including melanoma, colon cancers, lung cancers, prostate cancers. Basically, things that are common in the general population were also common in our CLL patients. I think melanoma risk was a little higher even than we expected in the CLL patient population. Bladder cancer was a little bit higher as well.
So you had this patient with the transformation, and there are tons of questions that people have about that. So maybe you can hear about him, a 71-year-old man.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting patient who was getting his first-line treatment for CLL, was treated with ibrutinib in the context of a clinical trial. At the time he started, he actually, in addition to, you know, a lot of lymph nodes elsewhere, had some lesions in his spleen. And so, you know, after about 6 months of treatment, because he was on a trial, we did another set of CAT scans, and all of his lymph nodes had regressed except for these splenic lesions had gotten bigger. And this gentleman actually had no problems at all. He felt really well. He really didn't have any side effects from the ibrutinib either. And we weren't really sure what these lesions in the spleen were. His LDH wasn't high and had no lab abnormalities. We waited a couple more months and repeated the CAT scans, and actually the lesions in the spleen had continued to grow. So we eventually did a biopsy, and he had diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Upon further testing, it actually was clonally related to his CLL too. So it's kind of an odd case of Richter's, because usually we expect these patients are going to present with a lot of systemic symptoms. Usually we see fevers, chills, night sweats, weight loss, just general malaise. Most times you'll see an elevated LDH. Sometimes you even see other markers of like spontaneous tumor lysis. This gentleman had none of these things. but he did have a clonally related Richter's transformation. So we're actually treating him on a clinical trial that's giving our EPOC chemotherapy in combination with venetoclax. And he is on his third cycle and has done very well so far.
I'm trying to remember when I've heard about venetoclax and chemo together.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the initial experience with venetoclax plus chemotherapy was that there was a lot more neutropenia. So this current study actually only gives venetoclax for the first 10 days of each chemo cycle, which seems to help a lot with the neutropenia.
Anyhow, it seems like a super cool idea.
Yeah.
Any initial data on this strategy, or is it too early?
So it's too early. It's actually a multi-center trial. It's led by Matt Davids at Dana-Farber. And there's a number of centers that are participating. It, I think, is fully accrued right now. So hopefully there'll be some data relatively soon.
Can you talk about what we know about Richter's transformation, the treatment, and also prognosis?
Yep. So unfortunately, Richter's transformation is a pretty dreaded complication in CLL. If you look at kind of all of the data, there's a lot of smaller case series because it at least used to be not that common. And overall survival kind of historically is between 6 and 12 months, so really poor. There are a number of studies looking at different interventions which improve that outcome a little bit, but really not much. In the novel therapy era, most people are saying that they're seeing more cases of Richter's transformation. For myself, that's definitely true. There's a lot of debate on why that is. I think most people think that it is more likely that maybe their patients are predisposed to Richter's, have already some lymphoma cells pre-existing the novel therapy. Maybe there's even some sort of competitive pressure with the CLL and the Richter's cells. You eliminate the CLL with these highly effective therapies, and then the Richter's has the opportunity to grow.
And I guess that sort of seems like what happened with this man. He had the splenic lesions at the beginning, right?
Yeah, with this patient, I think that's definitely the case. And we, you know, there's other cases where patients develop Richter's within a week or 2 weeks of starting a therapy. And I mean, you have to think that that was present prior to starting treatment. You know, there was an interesting study that Anthony Mato led where in the trial of venetoclax after either ibrutinib or idelalisib, the study was structured to try to eliminate patients with Richter's going on to the trial. So there was like a very strict screening for Richter's prior to going on to the venetoclax, including for most patients a PET scan and then a biopsy. And what they found was that the incidence of Richter's was much higher than you would expect. And the traditional things that we think either predicts Richter's or predicts no Richter's, such as a SUV of less than 5 not being associated with Richter's, isn't always the case. High LDH isn't always associated with Richter's. You can have Richter's with a normal LDH. So I think we're still learning how best to figure out who has Richter's before starting these novel therapies. And then I think there always is the possibility that there is something about the drugs that changes the biology, and that's the escape mechanism is this transformation to Richter's. And whether that is that these patients would have done poorly with any other therapy or whether they actually do more poorly with the novel agent, I think it's still really unexplored.
What do we know about checkpoint inhibitors with transformed disease?
So there are a couple of small studies. There's one with pembrolizumab that came from the Mayo Clinic, one with nivolumab that came from MD Anderson, which showed pretty high response rates of Richter's transformation to checkpoint inhibitors. You know, at our institution, we looked retrospectively, you know, after those studies, we had put a few people on as just standard of care. And our experience with a checkpoint inhibitor as a single agent was very, very disappointing, in that almost nobody responded. It seems like in combination with ibrutinib, the checkpoint inhibitors might have a little bit more efficacy. And I know there's some ongoing studies that are looking at that. As well, you know, I think checkpoint inhibitors work in lymphoma. So I think there's still the potential for them to work. We're starting a study with duvelisib and nivolumab. So, you know, potentially like the immune activation you get from the PI3 kinase inhibitor might interact well with the checkpoint inhibitor. There's another study which is looking at a PI3 kinase inhibitor with a checkpoint inhibitor as well. That's kind of interesting.
PI3 kinase and checkpoint inhibitor, that sounds really interesting. That makes sense. We just try adding everything that checkpoint inhibitors affects the immune system, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Yeah, I'll tell you in about a year whether it works out or not.
What about CAR T in Richter's transformation?
So there's really limited data from some of the lymphoma trials. A few of them did let patients with Richter's in. It seems that it probably has some efficacy. Unlike de novo diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I don't think that it is going to be a home run for most patients, though.
So another one of these surprises as oncologists get on, seems like every day when new drugs come on the market, polatuzumab vedotin just came out for diffuse large B-cell. How about that with transformed CLL?
You know, I don't know if there's any experience with that in transformed CLL.
I don't know whether you would expect it to work or not. I don't even really understand that biologic difference between transformed disease and diffuse large B-cell.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, Richter's had been so rare and, you know, there's kind of lack of samples to look at. But I think that they're, despite looking very similar under a microscope, I think that they're very, very different entities, Richter's and even other transformed indolent lymphomas.
Anything else going on in CLL? It's amazing that you can talk so much about CLL nowadays. We did a two-hour symposium on it at the Pan Pacific meeting this year, and we didn't even get through half the stuff we wanted to get through. But anyhow, anything else that we haven't talked about, new directions that you're excited about?
You know, I really am excited about this possibility of combinations of kinase inhibitors or other combinations with novel therapies to potentially limit the duration of therapies and, you know, hopefully get people to very long-term remissions off drugs. So the studies at ASH that were kind of comparing ibrutinib to chemotherapy, there's two successor trials that are ongoing right now. The ECOG study, it's EA9161, and this is for patients under the age of 70, comparing ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab versus ibrutinib venetoclax obinutuzumab. And so the patients that are in the triple therapy arm will all discontinue treatment after about 18 months of therapy. So it's kind of comparing indefinite ibrutinib to ibrutinib venetoclax obin with a planned discontinuation. The Alliance's successor is A041702, and this is for patients age 70 and older. Again, actually, the treatment arms are the same. So ibrutinib plus obinutuzumab with ibrutinib given indefinitely versus ibrutinib venetoclax obinutuzumab. And the difference with this study is at 1 year, so 14 cycles, patients will undergo a response evaluation. Anybody in an MRD negative CR will discontinue all treatment. Anybody who's still MRD positive or not in a complete response will continue ibrutinib indefinitely. So this study is kind of comparing a strategy of a risk-adapted discontinuation.
So people are certainly not looking to add another arm onto a phase 3 trial, but I am kind of curious why there's no ibrutinib alone arm there. You know, it's ibrutinib obinutuzumab.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, it's mostly a function of when the studies were designed. So the studies were designed before the Alliance trial came out showing that at least with rituximab, there wasn't a difference with the antibody versus monotherapy.
So I guess you could go through the whole trial, and if that's positive, you can still throw out the CD20, I guess.
Yeah, I think so.
We'll see if by then we know any more about it. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Update.